Chapter 6. The Rocks Remain. Sun glints splinter from a sea swollen by vanished polar caps. It is 80 million years ago. Today's continental jigsaw is half finished. The Pyrenees and Alps yet to heave their heights up. Instead, where Europe will one day be, a subtropical kaleidoscope of archipelagos emerge and disappear as the oceans rise and fall. Titanosaur footsteps shake terra firma, while on briny coasts, the immense wings of pterosaurs lift them up above the sea. Their shadows rush over turquoise waves as a dark mass heaves beneath. A swarm of ammonites explodes, torpedoed by a mosasaur, and shell fragments glitter as they spiral slowly down. Soft muds blossom as the splinters land on the sea floor, an oozing wasteland. It's replenished by a never-ending drizzle of broken sponges, mollusks, and decaying forms of uncountable plankton. Spin the earth like a marble. Continents creep, muds thicken and squeeze, cementing to limestone. The newborn rock sweats out silica gel into voids, some inside ancient burrows, others filling miraculously unshattered shells. Place a finger on the marble to slow the spinning planet. Seas have drained. Sierras risen, and now vast ice caps pulse at the poles. As age upon age passed, immense pressures bore down, congealing the silica and germinating microscopic crystal lattices that evolved, shifted state, became flint. Far above, hoofed legs run across the land. Furred pelts are mussed by breezes. Waxing and waning climate cycles erode the limestone, while tectonics and rivers soar it down into winding, terraced canyons. A stormy afternoon, 100,000 years ago, the grey-green thundery squall hurls itself up one of the gorges. Rain-soaked rock gives way, slithers down, and disgorges a stony pearl among the rubble, black as the clouds. The flint splashes into the river below, joins the slow rolling bed of cobbles. For 50,000 years, it surges with floods, freezes into iced eddies, pauses for centuries on gravelly bars. One spring, the now rounded flint lies on a small bank, glistening after a rain shower. Above it, smoke blues the sky, trailing from a wide limestone shelter. People clatter down to the river, glancing as always at the stones, and the cobble's shine catches an eye. It's hefted up and down, tapped with another stone to call forth its clear voice. A few blows reveal good insides, smooth like old fat, and soon it will be slippery with bright blood. Stone tools were the atoms of Neanderthal life. They connected every aspect of their world and are the fundamental units with which archaeologists try to reconstruct their cultures. Known to researchers as lithics, each possesses a unique story arcing from rocky formation to the day a Neanderthal picked it up and onwards to rediscovery with the scrape of a trowel. Its geological heritage, whether under the sea, beneath mountain roots, or as flowing lava, dictates its character. It's also what caught the hominin gaze tens of millennia ago. But today, the eyes of museum visitors tend to slide over these objects. Kept in glass cases, they're hard to relate to when so few people have ever held one, never mind making and relying on them for daily survival. Their stark beauty may be appreciated, even exhibited in galleries as art, but to most, they remain mute. In truth, from individual objects to whole assemblages, lithics are extraordinarily rich sources of insight about Neanderthal lives. For early prehistorians, the most pressing concern was classification. Having little direct experience of the manufacture or use of lithics, they concentrated on appearance. Arranging objects according to visual similarity and very basic technological features allowed them to create typologies. One of the first to do this was de Joinet, who was not only digging up lithics very early on, but also trying to understand them. He assumed that they became more refined over time, and in 1834 produced a chronological typology, placing napped or chipped stone objects deeper in time than ground or polished tools. Over several decades, others sketched out cultural classifications that are essentially the same as those used today. In 1865, antiquarian John Lubbock coined the term Paleolithic for the most ancient prehistory. And later, Lachte and Christie proposed a tripartite subdivision. They perceived that lithics from some sites, including Le Moustier, were chronologically in between those from the Somme gravels, which they termed Lower Paleolithic, and blade-based tools from places like La Madeleine, labelled Upper Paleolithic. Concurrently, the French prehistorian Gabriel de Mortier used the lithics from Le Moustier as a type site and gave the first name to a Neanderthal Middle Paleolithic culture, the Mousterian. Yet the first Neanderthal fossils to be found seemed to have no accompanying artifacts. Lithics at Feldhofer went unnoticed, only rediscovered in quarrying waste in the 1990s. For some 30 years, the makers of the Mousterian were a mystery, and equally nobody knew if Neanderthals had material culture. The first observed association between skeletons and Middle Paleolithic artifacts was at Spee, and it took far longer for prehistorians to comprehend that Neanderthals manipulated stone in remarkably sophisticated ways. Unsurprisingly, 21st century lithic experts are a world away from typologists. Nothing is ignored, even tiny chips and splinters, and examining an assemblage can mean hundreds of hours of work. Yet, if recording the 10,000th artifact becomes tedious through repetition, one only need recall the preposterous privilege it is to simply hold such objects. Excavation and recording are increasingly digital and automated, but focused attention is still crucial in analysis. Each object becomes imprinted in memory as its creation is mentally reconstructed by reading technological stigmata on its surface. Here's where learning napping mechanics is necessary. The object to be worked, such as a cobble, is known as the core, and is struck with something harder. The parts that come off are called flakes. How this happens in practice is down to a mix of skill, geology, and physics. How hard and where one hits determines what the flake will be like. Kinetic energy spreads out in a cone shape from the point of percussion, and its edge is what forms one side of the flake. This process often leaves visible ripples on both the core's negative scar and the mirror image of the flake's inner surface. By looking for these and other distinctive napping features on cores and flakes, researchers can reconstruct the method of napping and, to some extent, its sequence, sometimes with a single artifact. Neanderthals as cavemen thugs whacking stones together is very far off the mark. How rocks react to napping reflects their structure. The more homogeneous and fine the particles are, the more predictable fracturing will be, and the sharper the flake's edges. Neanderthals gauge these characteristics by sight, touch, and even sound. High-quality stone, like flint, will often ring when struck. By using a variety of different napping methods and techniques, they could control the size and shape of a product from any given core, even with poorer quality rock, like quartzite. More artisans than klutzes, they appreciated the right tools for the job. Selecting hammers, the things that struck the cores, was crucial. Small cobbles have the necessary mass to hit hard for big flakes, but for more delicate work, pebbles are better. And using soft rather than hard hammers produces different effects. Elastic organic materials like antler and bone, or even less dense rock like limestone, spread out the kinetic energy and produce thinner, longer flakes. This was crucial when shaping was the goal, and for secondary napping or retouching. Tools, lithic artifacts that were used to do other things, were often retouched, sometimes to give a particular edge, but often to resharpen them. Flakes dull very fast, even when cutting meat. Neanderthals had patently mastered the basics of fragmenting stone, but where do they fit into the broader evolution of lithic technology? Going back 3.5 million years ago, the Australopithecine makers of the oldest known artifacts, crude flakes smacked off blocks, would have viewed Neanderthal napping with just as much awe as that practiced by early Homo sapiens. It took until roughly 2.5 million years ago for hominins to develop geometrical concepts, allowing them to begin truly controlling stone fracturing. The first centripetal cores appeared, with flakes carefully and sequentially removed from around the perimeter, leaving wheel spoke patterns. By 1.8 million years ago, the ability to mentally divide volumes is shown by the most visually iconic of all Paleolithic artifacts, bifaces. The manufacture of these two-sided tools, also known as hand axes, was possible due to growing use of soft hammers, allowing their surfaces to be shaped by shallow flaking. Taming your rock. Neanderthals inherited these already ancient ways of working stone and also made bifaces, but went a step beyond in managing material masses. Variegated systems for much more systematic, precise ways of getting large flakes, of course, began to emerge, and it's these that truly define the Middle Paleolithic. It first appears in Africa by around 500,000 years ago, probably made by populations ancestral to Homo sapiens. But in Europe, it really explodes just as we see Neanderthal anatomy fully materialise between 400,000 and 350,000 years ago. What makes Middle Paleolithic flaking different is that it further developed the conceptual division of stone blocks, with cores treated as two halves. By shaping the base and preparing special side zones to be struck, it was possible to guide how flakes came off the upper surface, controlling their shape and size. The first identification of this flagship Neanderthal technology was at the hand of Victor Comon, a prolific early 20th century amateur prehistorian who noted distinctive large flakes and cores turning up in quarries. The method is known as Le Valois, after his hunting ground, a rapidly expanding Parisian suburb pockmarked by industrial activity, and today Europe's most densely populated area. By the time of Peyronie and Bordes, the presence of Le Valois technology was noted in Mousterian as well as other Neanderthal cultures too. Sometimes the stone blocks being worked were huge, and initially, most prehistorians paid attention to a type of Le Valois where, after each main flake was removed, the upper surface and sides of the core needed reshaping. That fact led to Le Valois being regarded for some time as somewhat profligate, but decades of careful work has revealed it to be much more sophisticated and flexible. By taking off small, preparatory flakes in different patterns across the upper surface, Neanderthals created outlines that directed the kinetic energy of subsequent removals. Through varying the preparation phase, they could produce massive flakes, long blades, or even triangular points, sometimes making several in sequence before needing to reshape the surfaces. They also sometimes swap patterns on the same core. what transformed our understanding of Levallois and other Neanderthal technologies was when archaeologists began refitting knapped artifacts back together. Truly slow science, it is meticulous, time-consuming work, an immense 4D jigsaw, and demands well-preserved sites. But it's worth it. The next best thing to actually looking over Neanderthal's shoulders. For the first time, it was possible to reconstruct the thought processes and choices made by individual Neanderthals, revealing dynamic responses to each block of stone. The benefit in technological terms of Levallois and other prepared core methods is that Neanderthals now had reliable ways to get particular products, especially large, thin flakes. Unlike bifaces, they weren't much good for truly heavy-duty stuff, but for the same weight of stone. Highly portable Levallois flakes gave far greater amounts of cutting edge. Neanderthals were skilled enough to use prepared core technology on all kinds of rock, from very hard volcanic stone to tiny pebbles. Where there was good flint, such as in Britain or northern France, they sometimes made extraordinary giant flakes and points, 10 to 15 centimetres or 4 to 6 inches long. The other advantage that flakes of various kinds had over bifaces is that they were far more easily retouched. Although as a technique it was far more ancient, retouching really defines the Middle Paleolithic. Sometimes Neanderthals retouched a flake in order to adjust its edge to match a particular task. Blunting for scraping, creating notches or serrations for shaving and sawing. However, it's now understood that much, or even most, retouching was about resharpening edges. Fresh flakes quickly lose their razor sharpness, but it can be maintained by shallow, thin removals using soft hammers along the edge. However, the impact of systematic resharpening went further than individual artifacts. It expanded the scale at which Neanderthals were active. Longer-lasting flakes that were easily carried allowed them to move around over greater distances. Proof that this was going on comes from refitted Levallois knapping sequences where the flakes are missing, having been taken elsewhere, and from geological sourcing. Universally, Levallois and retouch tools were the most far-travelled objects. These new ways of engaging with stone meant Neanderthals were ranging across the landscape farther than any hominins before. While Levallois is often presented as the gold standard, it's far from the only thing Neanderthals did. It would require an entire volume to describe the whole gamut of knapping methods, known as techno-complexes, that they invented. But homing in on two just from Western Europe demonstrates quite how diverse their lithic world really was. Known as discoid, since some cores are disc-shaped, and kina, named for the type site, they were just as systematic as Levallois, but aimed at producing flakes with a sharp edge directly opposite a blunt one, a margin, providing built-in natural ergonomics. Yet, in all other ways, they were quite different technological beasts. For a long time, both were viewed primarily as adaptations to bad stone, but since the 1990s, this view has transformed, and they're now understood as techno-complexes in their own right. Looking first at discoid, it turns out to be a masterclass in economy. The cores need only a few initial preparatory flakes to create decent knapping angle, and every flake thereafter is the good stuff. Sharp but easy to handle and ready to use. What's more, each removal creates the surface for the next strike, with no need to stop and refashion the surface. Far from simple or unsophisticated, discoid technology provided Neanderthals with a zero-waste system, not far off production line efficiency. Moreover, it's just as flexible as Levallois, since differently shaped products could be created from oblong pieces to pointed ones, each with its handy blunted back like a penknife. Thanks to 3D refitting methods, it's possible to follow an individual Neanderthal using discoid napping on one day somewhere around 46,000 years ago in the southern Italian Alps. Up a narrow road winding past cliffs, Fomane Cave sits quite unassuming behind security fences. We'll return to other aspects of its exceptionally important archaeology later. But the discoid lithic assemblage of level A9 contained a special find. Excavators uncovered a cluster of artifacts nestled together across just a few centimetres, all made of the same distinctive grey stone. By combining hand and digital refitting methods, an exceptionally complete discoid core sequence was reconstructed. After sourcing a flint cobble from the nearby stream, a Neanderthal had sat down and napped over 60 flakes in 10 phases until just a small lump remained. The 14 pieces missing from the reassembled jigsaw were almost all the best, with long, fine edges opposite blunt backs. None of the other 8,000-plus lithics in the layer matched, so they must have been taken out of the site. The grey flint core and its flakes stood out because of their colour, but technologically everything else in level A9 told the same story. Neanderthals here were totally focused on discoid technology, but not uncreatively. As napping progressed and each core got smaller, they altered their technique to produce differently shaped flakes. Working out what discoid was especially good for isn't straightforward. Just like with teeth, using lithics leaves wear on the surface. By comparing artifacts with experimental collections, it's possible to identify the substances processed. Based on use wear of discoid artifacts, the strong, short, and thick flakes were often applied to hard materials like bone and wood, but Neanderthals were also happy to use them for butchery. What makes discoid truly distinctive from Levallois or Kina is that the flakes were very rarely retouched. It's no coincidence that broadly they also tend to be made using nearby stone within 15 kilometres, about 10 miles. In contrast, in the average Levallois and Kina assemblage, a number of artefacts will be made from rock from distant sources. That tells us two things. First, discoid technology was specialised, yet somewhat disposable. The flakes weren't intended to last long and be transported elsewhere. Second, this kind of techno-complex would only have suited Neanderthals who knew the rock resources extremely well and weren't regularly moving long distances. The third key techno-complex made by Western European Neanderthals was the Kina. Prehistorians originally focused on its distinctive, steeply retouched scraping tools. But in recent decades, attention shifted to how it worked as a system for making big flakes perfectly suited to resharpening. Unlike Levallois, Kina flakes bit away at the cores rather than shaved across them. In this sense, it's conceptually more like discoid, but rather than fat chunks, Kina flakes are like badly sliced bread, one edge thicker than the other. When the stone nodules used were cylindrical, the impression is more of sausage slices. This made the Kina similarly efficient to discoid, with little initial shaping or ongoing core maintenance needed. What mattered to Kina-making Neanderthals wasn't the overall shape of their flakes, but their features. The Kina was all about getting the longest, thinnest edge possible opposite a thick, blunt margin, requiring a particular, very hard way of striking. The point was to produce perfect flakes that could withstand intense and repeated resharpening, even the retouch almost always forming a scraper edge rather than a serrated one, was peculiarly specific, using a unique motion that essentially tore the stone off. In some sites, limestone hammers as well as bone retouchers were favoured, but everywhere the intensity of resharpening was clear. Sometimes four or more retouch faces are identifiable. Each time the edge steepened as it moved back towards the thicker margin. For Neanderthals, Kiener combined low waste with abundant, ready-to-use flakes that could withstand heavy use and resharpening. It's fundamentally about anticipating future tool maintenance, both within sites and during longer movements across the landscape. However cleverly Neanderthals made flakes, for many decades it appeared that they were unable to produce lithic blades, which define the subsequent Upper Paleolithic culture made by Homo sapiens. But the reality is more nuanced. Neanderthals did develop blades from around 300,000 years ago, producing large, wide examples as part of the Levallois system. Later, they also began to experiment with true blade or laminar technology, defined by products twice as long as they are wide. They used pre-formed linear ridges running from one or both ends of a core, which could direct the kinetic energy and ensured that the shape of each removal would be highly elongated. This is a systematic, nearly continuous process, with each blade setting up the spot where the next strike would be. There was still a distinctly Neanderthal flavour to this technology, however. Unlike Upper Paleolithic knappers, they used stone hammers instead of bone, and generally prepared cores much less. But these weren't substandard, and could be impressively large. Refitting at the early site of Torville-la-Rivière has found blades over 10 centimetres or 4 inches long. The most striking Neanderthal blade culture took place in post-Eemian MIS5 in northwest Europe, where blades were quite common in some sites over about 20,000 years, often alongside Levallois flaking. Yet this phenomenon doesn't persist. Blades do appear again elsewhere, but they're never dominant, nearly absent in some areas like Iberia, and quite variable. Neanderthals at Fermanagh Cave were making blades within Levallois-based knapping, but shifted the precise technique over time. And sometimes they went micro. Around 80 to 70,000 years ago, in the deep sequence of Combe Granal, southwest France, up to a fifth of all artefacts were related to laminar knapping. Some were really tiny, under 3 centimetres or 1.2 inches long, known rather sweetly by archaeologists as bladelets. It's long been assumed by post hoc reasoning that laminar technology must be better since later Homo sapiens made more of it. But what did it actually offer? Experiments suggest blades aren't vastly more economical than flakes or better for slicing. Moreover, they can barely be resharpened and by themselves are no good for long-term use. What they lack in robustness is made up for in their standardised rectangular shape. It's highly likely that at least some, especially bladelets, were used in composite tools, which, as the next chapter will show, was definitely within Neanderthals' capability. Being easy to slot in and out, just like blades on a craft knife, they provided sharp edges of a different sort. Since thousands of years separate the different laminar phases at Combe Granal and many other sites, this implies that Neanderthals may have invented the use of blades multiple times. Varied methods of making flakes, and, to a lesser extent, blades, dominated Neanderthal technology in many ways, but the older legacy of bifaces was not forgotten. Though typically rare in the earlier Middle Paleolithic, from about 150,000 years ago, there's a resurgence in bifaces as part of growing technological diversity. Yet this doesn't happen everywhere, and neither were Neanderthal bifaces technologically identical to those of the Lower Paleolithic. Just like their more ancient counterparts, they used bifaces as multi-purpose tools with edges that could effectively pierce, slice, or scrape materials. Use wear shows that they were used on materials from meat to wood, but it also shows that this happened through many phases of use, sometimes with more than one material on the same artifact. That's because, just like some kinds of flakes, Neanderthals were resharpening them an awful lot. But they used different technique, often striking very shallow flakes across the tip or down the main working edge. It was possible in this way to rejuvenate the margin many times while keeping the angle relatively acute. This meant that bifaces could be nearly as long-lived and far-travelled as things like Levallois flakes or Kena scrapers. The discovery of some biface workshop sites, often near very good flint sources, shows this in practice. A single layer at the Pêche de Lazay 1 rock shelter contains nearly 25,000 distinctive biface shaping flakes. The average Napa produces fewer than 50 during initial production, so over 500 bifaces must have been made here. Yet very few were actually found. Clearly, after making them, Neanderthals were taking them elsewhere. In other places, it's possible to see what happened on these biface journeys. In 2002, at Linford Quarry, Eastern Britain, beneath metres of gravel, Middle Paleolithic artefacts were noticed coming from black organic sludges. This sediment came from a small river course that, 60,000 years ago, was on the margins of a great plain now submerged under the English Channel. It produced thousands of lithics, including around 50 bifaces. Some had been quickly made on cobbles from the nearby river, but most had been napped elsewhere using beautiful black flint before being used at Linford and then discarded. Why would Neanderthals leave so many bifaces, most still usable? In fact, to experienced nappers, they're quick and easy to make, much less bother than a Levallois core. For Neanderthals, who mastered napping as youngsters and knew the location of good stone like the back of their hand, lugging bifaces wasn't always the wise choice. Far better to carry more meat, fat, or other materials. Nonetheless, where decent stone was scarce, bifaces were hoarded and only discarded as heavily resharpened hulks at the end of their life. We can even find the in-between places where solely resharpening flakes remain as witnesses to Neanderthals staying perhaps just for a night, sharpening their tools and carrying them on further. Rocky generations. Whether making bifaces, blades or flakes, something many Neanderthals had in common was their fondness for a good second-hand deal. Recycling could be simple, but a pioneering refitting study from 3 decades ago shows how, in other cases, it was quite elaborate. Similar to the distinctive discoid core at Fermanagh Cave, an excavator at Coustal Cave, south-central France, spotted a cluster of jasper artefacts, an unusual stone that wasn't available locally. Almost all were within 1 metre square, or 1.2 yards square, and when reassembled demonstrated an extraordinary transformation in reverse. A Neanderthal had originally brought a long serrated flake tool into the site and likely used it, then converted it to a core and back again to a tool through 8 stages. This single object highlights how Neanderthals could effortlessly shift in treating artefacts as one category or another, altering the napping methods used. But it's not an anomaly. Refitting at Cwm Gronnal shows how a different Neanderthal rescued a botched blade core by serrating the edge, turning a mistake into a useful tool. What happened at Coustal was probably the work of the tool's original maker. But in other contexts, it's possible to see that considerable time passed before recycling happened. Le Moustier contains striking evidence of this habit of repurposing already ancient artefacts. Recent reassessment of bifaces from the base of one layer found distinct colour differences, showing that, rather than being badly made, they had been scavenged from the underlying level and recycled into cores. Despite being totally focused on discoid technology, it's inconceivable these later Neanderthals didn't recognise the bifaces as having been tools, even if they were only interested in them as an easy source of good flint. Recycling artefacts is actually very common across many sites, and it seems that just as the eyes of archaeologists are drawn magpie-like to glinting lithics, Neanderthals would have homed in on exposed artefacts inside caves or in open-air locales. Such encounters may well have been the genesis for an appreciation of old objects, not just as sources of stone, but as tokens of time, history, and even the presence of those before. While Neanderthals' habit of recycling lithics has long been known, something much more extraordinary has only recently been appreciated. Known as ramification, it's thanks to refitting that researchers uncovered the existence of hidden subsystems of napping. Somewhat like tributaries from a river, Neanderthals were taking the flakes they made with primary methods and then further reduced them into a second generation of tiny flakes. This is easiest to do on thick artefacts, and sizable things like large Levallois or Kina flakes with fat bases or edges were ideal. In some contexts, ramification is so systematic that Neanderthals were obviously not just viewing their lithic technology as about fragmenting stone, but as a means of producing portable reserves of rock that could then be treated as mini cores. There were a multitude of second-generation approaches, some of which were aimed at making miniature versions of the original flakes. By taking out notches from keener flakes or tools, Neanderthals obtained little second-generation flakes that had exactly the same properties as the first-generation products, napped direct from the core, a sharp edge opposite a naturally blunt one. Remarkable research combining refitting and useware at the site of Jonzac, not far from Saint-Césaire, highlights the astonishing consistency in some second-generation systems. Originally exposed when 19th century quarrying cut through deep archaeological layers against a limestone cliff, one layer contains masses of animal bones, mostly reindeer, which had been intensively butchered. Keener lithics were used to cut up carcasses and scrape flesh off skins, typically being resharpened at least once before then being put to use for very heavy work, probably chopping bone. This led to splintered edges, at which point some then had notches removed, so they could be used again, while others became hammers or anvils. But that's just the main sequence. There was also a second generation cycle using all the smaller flakes that came off during shaping and resharpening of the tools. Neanderthals were using roughly half, some of them retouched, but most fascinatingly, there was further selection in what the second generation flakes were used for. Those flakes that came from tool shaping were employed for butchery and to clean fresh skins, just like the original keener scrapers. In contrast, flakes that came from resharpening were only used to cut meat, and sometimes themselves resharpened. Even the bits that came off when battered keener tools were notched were requisitioned, but again, only for cutting meat. These specific patterns may be unique to the groups that visited Jonzac, but they exemplify how Neanderthals in all places and times were hyper aware of the material potential of everything they made. This waste-not-want-not attitude has been identified across virtually all techno-complexes. Back at Fomani Cave in one layer, thrifty Neanderthals were taking bladelets off the edges of flakes. Occasionally, there's even a third generation. At Comgrenal, after turning discoid flakes into micro-cores for making diminutive points, they then napped off tiny blades and bladelets. In some settings, it looks like Neanderthals used ramification to manage scarce, high-quality stone, but it could also function as a time-saving device, making the most out of decent pieces from among plentiful but bad rock. Yet it's intriguing to note that stone availability isn't always the motivation. Instead, as at Schonzach, specialization in activities underlies why Neanderthals made very small artifacts. Though some probably could be used in the hand, others, like petite Levallois flakes, just 2 centimeters or 0.8 inches long, from Pêche de Lazé 4, would surely have been hafted. And it's worth noting that all bladelets made by Neanderthals were produced within second generation systems. This strongly implies that bladelets were not accidental napping byproducts, but were integrated within technological systems, part of the diverse range of artifacts they were aiming to make from the outset. An embarrassment of riches. Over the past several decades, the overarching story has been that Neanderthals used stone in more systematic, complicated, and nuanced ways than was ever suspected. But explaining why they invented so many ways of going about this has long been an enigma. The typological obsessions of early prehistorians culminated in Bode's production between the 1950s and 1960s of a definitive Neanderthal tool catalogue. It had over 60 categories, with the edge number, location, and shape of tools being counted as different types. Comparing Le Moustier to his excavations at Cumgranal, comprising 50 layers through a sequence 13 metres or 43 feet deep, Bode picked out repeated patterns in relative amounts of tool types, and on this basis proposed that Neanderthals had lived in 5 main Mousterian subcultures, one of which included Kena. Although extraordinarily influential as a heuristic tool for recording assemblages, Bode's explanations didn't account for technology as a dynamic process. Ethnography combined with newfangled computer analysis led to the realization that a lot of the tool variability simply reflected function, Neanderthals doing different things in different places. Observations within hunter-gatherer communities showed that retouching of flakes was often about resharpening them, rather than setting out to create a particular edge. One 1970 study reported that historically, Aboriginal nappers paid as much attention to the overall appearance of their scrapers as Westerners do to their pencil sharpeners. This meant that Bode's tool categories were actually more like points on a spectrum as Neanderthals rejuvenated the edges of their tools. Furthermore, when the methods of core flaking were considered rather than just shapes of retouched tools, things got much messier. For example, a succession of 10 layers from late MIS5 to early MIS4 at Cumgranal look quite dissimilar based on Bode's tool categories. But in terms of how the flakes were made in the first place, they're virtually all Levallois. The other problem with the typologies is the relatively recent recognition of 2 things. First, many of the assemblages Bode's analysed came from quite thick layers. Almost everywhere, recent geologically based analysis indicates that such deposits contain many separate phases. Le Moustier is a case in point. 4 originally defined layers turned out to contain at least 20 sedimentary levels, and when the lithic assemblages are examined at this finer resolution, there are definite technological differences. What Bode saw as a single biface-dominated phase, in fact, begins mostly as Levallois. This might sound like an academically arcane issue, but it matters, because for many years, prehistorians built large-scale behavioural models based on connecting particular types of Mousterian with the climate or the animals being hunted. Today, it's obvious those models don't stand up to scrutiny, even if variation in technologies and the amount of retouching between different sites and phases is real. And this is where the second recent shift in understanding is important. Very often, early excavators kept little besides the retouched tools. They threw away many cores and virtually all the small flakes. Yet, as researchers paid more attention to technology, experimenting with their own napping, and attempting refitting, they realised that the practice of discarding supposed waste artefacts from archaeological assemblages meant the loss of vast amounts of information on how Neanderthals made things. Once again, Le Moustier is a case in point. Unexcavated areas show the layers here are so rich there's sometimes more archaeology than dirt. Yet considering the gigantic amounts of sediment removed by Hauser and Peyronie, the amount of lithics in the old collections is paltry. Rather than writing everything off, however, the current generation of researchers have returned more than a century later to excavate the excavation. Their field seasons are ambassadors for 21st century methods. Over several weeks, the depth might increase by less than a hand's span, because everything is kept. Pieces over 2 centimetres or 0.8 inches have their precise 3D coordinates plotted using lasers, while anything smaller is located to within a 50 centimetre or 20 inch grid square. Truly minuscule splinters are recovered through wet sieving. This modern total collection policy, combined with meticulous examination of technological details, has led to a new appreciation for the complex interplay between Neanderthals and stone at both individual and assemblage level. Formalised as the theory of techno-economics, it explains to a large degree why they chose to nap in particular ways and varied the intensity of retouching. Consistent patterns exist across virtually every site, confirming that not only did they preferentially choose high quality stone when expecting artefacts to require resharpening due to long-term use, but for the same reason it's the largest flakes that tend to be retouched. And when Neanderthals transported objects between sites, they moved those made from the best rock farthest, never bothering to carry poor quality stone to richer areas. This implies not only constant weighing up and decision-making, but an extraordinary knowledge of the geology across wide regions. Change and time. Yet that's not the end of the story. While, as a rule, available stone resources remained largely unchanged through time, the techno-complexes were not static. One enduring legacy of Bord's typology is that the different assemblage types do seem to show a chronological pattern when compared stratigraphically between numerous sites. Across southwestern France, Neanderthals were making a lot of Levallois-rich assemblages during MIS5, but far less so as time went on. Instead, in MIS4, the Kiena techno-complex appears, but is then itself succeeded by growing amounts of discoid technology, as well as some assemblages with numerous bifaces. Remarkably, this sequence has persisted over the past 30 years, although some nuances have been added. There's definite overlap in some places. For example, Kiena lasts into MIS3, when many discoid assemblages have already appeared. And the very youngest layers, only preserved at some sites, but always above the late discoid, see a reappearance of Levallois with large scrapers. This flowering of technological diversity from about 150,000 years onwards didn't happen in the same way everywhere. Neanderthals in other regions were doing different things at different times. While the caves of southwest France got the lion's share of research historically, spreads of lithics across the plains of northern France were harder to understand. That changed over the past few decades, with accurate dating methods uncovering a different technological sequence. Though the precise reasons why are still the subject of debate, there seems to be a much clearer correlation with the region's more severe climatic and environmental fluctuations compared to the south of France. As the climate began to cool after the Eemian peak around 123,000 years ago, Neanderthals there favoured simpler flaking methods than typical Levallois. Then, during a cold dip around 110,000 to 109,000 years ago, that fluorescence of blades mentioned earlier takes place, conditions seesawed over the next 20,000 years, boreal forest repeatedly growing and disappearing, but overall it steadily grew colder. Blades persisted, but in more diverse forms, and Neanderthals explored new Lavalwa methods, as well as invented a streamlined approach to making points. The end of MIS5 witnessed rapid, dramatic, repeated cycles from warm to cold. Neanderthals are most clearly visible when the forests rebounded, and once again they're making a range of lithics. But as it got colder and massive aridity led to vast steppe taking over, bifaces became important for the first time in hundreds of thousands of years. In the space of 10 generations, full-on glacial conditions kicked in at the beginning of MIS4. And though Neanderthals making large Lavalwa flakes pop up during brief thawings, eventually northern France seems to have been abandoned. While Neanderthals rematerialised almost immediately with rising temperatures at the transition between MIS4 and MIS3, culturally they now looked very similar to those from southwest France. Lavalwa points and true blades vanish for good, but is this because they were no longer useful, having been developed in earlier forest steppe environments? Or were they the work of unique Neanderthal cultures that went extinct during MIS4? It's intriguing that these northern French populations during MIS5 display much more obvious technological exclusivity, which could support the cultural interpretation. Blades, bifaces, and points all occur with Discoid and Lavalwa, but never with each other, intimating that these were either fulfilling very specific functions at particular places or reflecting cultural traditions. Beyond northern France, one of the strongest cases for true Neanderthal lithic cultures exists at a much larger scale. A distinct biface divide splits Europe down the middle, with the West as a Mousterian world where bifaces followed ancient traditions. Broadly symmetric, they have sharp perimeters flaked all or most of the way round. In contrast, Neanderthals in central Eastern Europe developed a very different way of doing bifaces. Known collectively as the Keil-Messe-Gruppen, they're defined by asymmetry, with one bifacial sharp edge opposite a natural or artificially blunted margin. Mousterian and Keil-Messe-making Neanderthal nappers lived at the same time, used both Lavalwa and Discoid for flake production, and hunted similar species. Nonetheless, they held totally different ideas on what a biface was, from how it should be made to resharpening methods. Clearly, there was a cultural border of some sort, but unpicking whether it was to do with populations who never came into contact, or something more subtle, remains a significant challenge. And enigmas also exist about the main techno-complexes. Discoid and Lavalwa were apparently widely known technologies, yet, wherever we find the former, it's almost always the only method being used. Did some Neanderthal groups traditionally learn only to nap this way, or did they do different things elsewhere? Our inability to truly track groups from site to site means we need to look for other clues. The possibility that particular techno-complexes were adaptations to certain environments is appealing. But for neither Lavalwa nor Discoid does it really hold up. Moreover, there's very little evidence from useware that the tasks they were used for were any different. There is one techno-complex that is quite restricted geographically, shows a strong climatic correlation, and is never found with any other core technology, the Kina. This could therefore represent a particular way of Neanderthal life, and we'll explore this further in Chapter 10. But what's notable in terms of thinking about technological diversity as being potentially related to different cultures across the continent is that the Kena appears in southern France right around the time blade technology disappears in the north and later fades out just as bifaces increase in importance. For the last 40,000 years of their existence, Neanderthals were manifestly experiencing massive upheavals in climate and potentially also population disruption. But rather than failing to adapt, their archaeological record is brimming with evidence of innovation and cultural evolution. Weaving it together. Though Neanderthals' lithics were collected for over a century, it took decades for them to be systematically studied. Thanks to advances both in thinking and analytical methods, today we have unprecedented insights into what they were doing with stone and why. Researchers zoom in and out from continental scales to single refitting sequences, while some of the greatest modern insights have come from the humblest objects. The stony dross they threw away by the ton. A crucial lesson has been that, while Neanderthals undoubtedly had cultural norms, they were also innovative individuals. It took someone each time to devise and refine different techniques, whether adapting to an unfamiliar type of rock or the invention in many times and places of blades. The enduring myth that Neanderthal technology was stuck in some kind of cognitive mire, bogged down by minds unable to innovate, is false. These were neither unsophisticated nor fixed and unvarying people. Theirs was a dynamic dance with stone, waltzing to different rhythms that merged external factors with ideas, choices, foibles. Elemental boundaries, what the geology made possible or prevented, surely imposed constraints. But thanks to technical mastery and a laser focus on what they wanted, creative responses were possible. As routinely as breathing, Neanderthals paid attention to their rock, selecting the choicest types, playing with novel ways to fragment, shifting concepts and skills as needed. Their technologies were also centered on quality and efficiency. Even if Levallois began the Neanderthals' Middle Paleolithic Revolution, a bouquet of other techno-complexes and particular methods blossomed. Time, as well as stone, was managed, whether via sustainable technologies that could be carried and resharpened many times, or disposable flakes made for the moment. In addition, over time, they developed more complex ways of obtaining what they wanted. The icing on the cake was ramification, with second generations of lithics splitting material up in more complicated and specialised ways than ever before. Nothing they did was thoughtless, and while they followed structures, flexibility was there too in the shifting between categories, such as flake to core or waste to tool. All these features underpinned how Neanderthals' very world was growing. They were untethering themselves from geology, and in the process opening up the landscape to ever farther exploration. By increasingly separating where and when they made, used, and resharpened artifacts, their activities and minds stretched through space and time. More lengthy activities and movements imply expanded memory and planning. With the Middle Paleolithic, we're witnessing, if not the birth, then the maturing of minds with the ability to fly into the future and imagine what would happen days or even seasons in advance. Put this all together and you perceive Neanderthals as hominins at the top of their game. Their lithic technologies seem to have buffered them from all but the toughest climatic and environmental challenges, potentially even stimulating new inventions. From 150,000 years ago onwards, there is a strong impression that they evolved ever more creative solutions as their geographical range expanded. Thinking of Neanderthals as experimenters pushing boundaries may be unfamiliar, but this new view is grounded in the archaeology. Excitingly, it's also there in materials much rarer than stone, The true scale of their nearly vanished organic technological world is just now being appreciated.